We would like to take a moment to thank our sponsor, Preborn. When a mother meets her baby on ultrasound and hears their heartbeat, it's a divine connection, and the majority of the time she will choose life, but they can't do it without your help. Preborn needs us, the pro-life community, to come alongside them. One ultrasound is just $28. To donate, dial #250 and say the keyword baby, or visit preborn.com/AFR.
We inform.
Religious freedom is about people of faith being able to live out their faith, live out their convictions, no matter where they are.
We equip.
Sacred honor is the courage to speak truth, to live out your free speech.
We also rejoice in our sufferings because we know that suffering produces perseverance, perseverance character, and character hope.
This is At the Core on American Family Radio.
Welcome to The Core here on American Family Radio. Glad to have you with us on today's edition of the program. Walker Wildman and Rick Green, we're your hosts each week on the program. I'm with you most Monday, Wednesdays, and Fridays, and then Rick's with you on Tuesday, Thursday. Once again, it's good to be with you today on the program. We've got a lot of content, a couple of guests coming up in the next few segments, and so we'll try to utilize our time wisely. Acts chapter 15 is where we have been this week. Acts chapter 15 is where we have been reading from, verses 1 and 2. And certain men came down from Judea and taught the brethren, unless you are circumcised according to the customs of Moses, you cannot be saved. Therefore, when Paul and Barnabas had no small dissension and dispute with them, they determined that Paul and Barnabas and certain others of them should go up to Jerusalem to the apostles and the elders about this very question. And so here, Paul and Barnabas are defending the core tenet of the Christian faith, and that is that salvation is not man-made, man-acquired, or man-earned. It is through faith alone in the Son of God, the Messiah, and that's what Paul and Barnabas were defending here in Acts chapter 15. Very, very important, as even today, some 2,000 years later, folks are still trying to add to the doctrine, add to the scriptures, and make salvation about more than what Jesus said it was about and the requirement of belief and faith in Jesus for salvation. So that's Acts chapter 15, verses 1 and 2. Well, the Truth for Youth campaign is going on this week. TFY.org is the URL. We're trying to send 65,000 Bibles into America's schools through youth ages 13 to 18 is our target audience here. Of course, we want parents and grandparents and those involved to be involved in this. But we're sending these Truth for Youth Bibles into America's schools through our youth ages 13 to 18. So if you want to order your free Bible this week on AFR, you can visit tfy.org, tfy.org. I'll give out the number to call in as well and order your Bible. 800-733-4737. If you call this number, you can order one Bible per teen in your home to send with them to school to give out to an unbeliever. 800-733-4737 or tfy.org. Our goal is 65,000 for the week. We are well underway, nearing the halfway mark for that goal. And so help us reach that goal and order your free Bible now at tfy.org. All right, well, let's jump into the topics for this segment. The economic data just continues to come out week after week, month after month, showing the progress of President Trump's agenda to rebuild the economy and fix the damage that was done under President Biden, which was a lot of damage. And manufacturing has been a core tenet of President Trump's agenda for a long time, even going back to the first term. And the manufacturing numbers are looking good. Remember, this was his core campaign promise and one of his things that he had worked on in the months after being sworn in this go-around, and that is traveling around to plants and factories and job sites in order to rebuild America's manufacturing base. Because let's not forget, over the last 30 to 40 years, really 40, over the last 40 years, we have shipped many of our manufacturing jobs overseas. And we've had things made in Mexico and Canada and China and Taiwan and all these other places, rebuilding or building their economies, their manufacturing base. President Trump said, let's bring it home. Let's bring manufacturing home. You add security to the supply chain and you add jobs for the American worker. That's what President Trump's been doing. So just this week, we have manufacturing numbers out. Largest manufacturing expansion in 4 years since 2022. Let's listen to this CNBC clip. This is going to be one.
If we look at manufacturing, these are fresh July reads from the ISM on manufacturing. Comes in much better than expected, 55.6. That would be the best read in over 4 years since May of 22.
Well, there you have it. Best reading since 2022, manufacturing expansion growing. There's also this database that Bobby made me aware of this morning called the American Factory Tracker, AmericanFactoryTracker.com. And this is tracking America's industrial comeback. Here are the stats just over the last 18 to 24 months, really 18 months. We've had $600 billion in verified investments in our manufacturing base. We've had about 160,000 job announcements over the last 2 years or so, and over 130 projects going on all around the country. These are major, not just data centers, not just AI centers, but vehicle plants. Lockheed Martin and others just announced a production capacity expansion, multi-billion dollar projects to increase our missile defense and interceptor capabilities and quadruple the ability to supply the military with certain interceptors. And states like Arizona, Texas, and Ohio are leading the way, and very positive signs there. And these are long-term investments. These aren't, you know, government-subsidized programs that last a year or two, and then they fade out, and then you leave people without a job. What this is doing is this is creating long-term manufacturing-based jobs around the country. And this is what President Trump, and we're going to link to that investment tracker, the American Factory Tracker on America's Industrial Comeback. But this is what President Trump's going to have to hammer home on the campaign trail. And honestly, if I were him, I'd stop talking about Iran, because we don't know where that's going to go. We don't know what's going to happen. You could have a deal, but you could not have a deal. And so, and I don't think you're going to have a deal. But this constant answering questions about Iran, I think, is a distraction for the midterms. I don't think President Trump needs to talk about Iran anymore. It is what it is. We're taking care of it. Let's talk about the economy. Let's talk about our manufacturing comeback. Let's talk about the largest number of individuals in the labor force in the last 50 years. Those are the things that I would be talking about, along with core inflation lower than it was under Biden. Now, there's some in categories like beef and energy that are still elevated, but the vast majority of the inflation tracker data is at 2% or below 2%. Let's listen to Alex Marlow. This is the Breitbart chief editor, talking about how President Trump is the best person to deliver the economic case to the American people.
I still think it's very good. Trump is very popular within his own party, and he's got a clear command of the party. And so I still think that even though the Iran war is not particularly popular, I think he's got a long time to make the case. And he's making a case against a very weak Democrat opponent. The entire party is overcome by socialism, and it's very incoherent with their anti-law enforcement, open borders, anti-Israel agenda. It's just they don't have a coherent case to make. It's very alarming for a lot of people, and Trump can make a much more sane case to people.
Well, there you have it. That's Alex Marlow from Breitbart talking about the need to for President Trump to deliver the message to the American people on the economic rebound that he is overseeing right now. And as I've said multiple times, you get past this Iran thing, whatever this Iran thing turns out to be, you get on the other side of it. You talk about a breakout. I mean, the market's having a breakout now. But everything else is going to break out because a lot of the consumer sentiment will improve. Energy prices will improve. We've got the nuclear modular reactors being built out, going to lower the cost to run your business. And so all of this is coming together. It just takes a little time. And the question is, do the American people have the patience and the wherewithal to give this process time? And the November election will tell us that. But the alternative here, and I'm writing a column on this right now for our Stand magazine, but the alternative here is destruction of Western civilization. That's the alternative. And that's not an exaggeration, but when you look at the two parties, when you look at the various ideologies, you have a very pro-business, pro-economic development, pro-national security party in the Republicans, and then you look across the aisle at the Democrats, and they want to burn it all down. Their words, to be specific, according to the Democrat Socialist of America, which is now pretty much the talking head of the Democrat Party, they said, we want to bring down the American empire. Those are their words, not mine. And so you look at the two sides, you've got one of revitalization, rebuilding America first, and then you've got the destruction of Western civilization, because without America, there virtually is no Western civilization. And so you can say, well, what about Europe? Well, look, America is the leader of Western civilization and one of the best nations in human history from multiple vantage points. And so we have to preserve that. That's what's at stake here on the ballot in November. And we also have to resist this perpetual victimhood mentality that is prevalent, I will say, within the right. Now, I know the term right with a capital R is a very broad term, but within kind of the conservative right base of the Republican Party, some of the more nationalist elements, there's some kind of disgruntledness about the lack of economic progress under President Trump's administration and claiming, you know, there's still an affordability issue, et cetera, et cetera. And they say that explains, you know, this drift towards socialism and government intervention on everything, which is what Elizabeth Warren wants. But we need to be careful with that line of thinking, and here's why. It is true that that America, that our economy in some regards has not been working for the little guy, or not been working more specifically for the middle class. That's a phenomena over the last, as I said, 30 to 40 years as we began shipping America's manufacturing base overseas. That gutted, in many regards, a lot of the middle class. So that is a problem. I'm not denying that. But President Trump is literally in the middle of reversing that trend and reversing that problem. And so the question I have is, if President Trump is doing what he can to reverse that manufacturing base gutting that happened starting with Clinton and Bush and Obama, then what are you going to replace that with? I mean, what are you going to intervene and do different than what the Trump administration is currently doing, other than socialism and the destruction of Western civilization and capitalism as we know it? And so, whether you like it or not, the Trump economic agenda is the best game in town. And as a matter of fact, it's pretty much the only game in town if you want to preserve anything that's a semblance of the American economy as we know it. And and some of this is just some of the criticisms on the economy and affordability and stuff is just unfounded. I mean, some of it's just outright unfounded. And we've got to be problem solvers. I mean, we got to be problem solvers, and we got to be leaders. And this is the core problem with the podcast world and the Tucker Carlson's, you know, and others, is, and Candace Owens, just to name a few, is they don't really fix problems. They've never had a career in fixing problems or finding solutions. All they do is talk. And so we can find a lot of people that can just talk and get ratings and do clickbait. But who's going to lead? And right now, over the last 10 plus years, President Trump's been one of the few that have raised his hand and said, I'll lead. I'll take the bullets, literally, and I'll lead this American comeback. And so that's where we are. We don't need to take that for granted. President Trump has had, listen to this, zero border apprehensions and releases at the southern border in the last 14 months. President Biden had 600,000 in his first 18 months. President Trump has effectively closed the southern border, no illegal immigration, mass deportations, and a manufacturing comeback. Let's not forget that.
America's 250th birthday. It's a great excuse to have some extra cake and ice cream, but we can help your celebration go well beyond that. Show your patriotism with America 250 apparel that will become a memento of this special year. We also have special episodes on AFA Stream to help underscore that America is a Christian nation and help you find God in the Constitution. Find all of this and more in one place. afa.net/topics/250.
At the Core podcasts are available at afr.net. Now, back to At the Core on American Family Radio.
Welcome back to The Core here on American Family Radio. Glad to be with you today on the program. As a brief reminder, we do upload the show in the form of a podcast each and every afternoon. So if you go to your podcast library, your podcast store, type in At the Core with Walker Wobbin and Rick Green, you can subscribe to the podcast there, or in some platforms, it's called following. They keep changing up the term, but you get the idea. Subscribe, follow the podcast, and it will be queued up in your library each and every day. Well, we have a guest in studio with us, a state representative from Mississippi, Shana Gary, and he asked coming into the break, do you know how to pronounce my last name? Surprisingly, I do, because most guests, I've had some doozies on here, Bobby, of guests with some last names that just throw me for a loop. And but yes, I've got your last name, and glad I do, as opposed to getting it wrong in real time. But glad to have you on the program.
Well, you'd be surprised how many people just butcher my last name. So I wanted to give you a heads up before we got started.
Yeah, Gary is proper, but Aguirre is probably what people go for at most of the time, just glancing at it. Yeah. But
9 times out of 10.
Yeah, pat on the back for me for figuring that out. If you don't mind, move a little bit closer to that mic. They're pretty sensitive. Representative Shana Gary is with us here from the state of Mississippi. He's been in the legislature for three terms. I didn't realize he'd been in that long, going on 12 years. And I'm going to run, I assume, for re-election in 2027.
That's the plan.
But you've been working with us and others on some debanking legislation this past legislative session, and hopefully we can get some momentum behind this bill coming up in the next term. But nonetheless, give us a little backgrounder on this subject of debanking. I know it's a word that people don't usually put in their vocabulary, but it's been a thing in recent years where people have had their bank accounts cut off for various ideological reasons.
Yeah, this is something that came up during the last presidential administration. They were using a banking system to cut off the funds for different groups based on a lot of their either religious views or conservative views or even their political affiliations. So this is something that I saw happening nationwide, and I thought, you know, we need to do something in Mississippi to try to offset this and make sure that they can't do this to our citizens.
Yeah. Banking is something that a lot of people probably just take it for granted, because there are, thankfully, a lot of banks and a lot of competition, a lot of places for consumers to go. But Representative Gary, the banking system is somewhat critical, it is critical, in 2026, and it has been for a couple of decades, with the online era and the digital era, in order to simply operate as a business or as an individual. So, you know, it's not the heavy cash days where, you know, if you didn't have a place to park the physical money, you could just, you know, take care of it yourself. If you don't have somewhere to bank because you've been shut down, or even if you have to transition because you've had your accounts cut off for political reasons, that's very disruptive. And so talk a little bit about the importance of just being able to have confidence that, your bank's not going to just cut you off one day without notice because they don't like the politics.
Yeah, you're right. You know, everything right now, we are moving further and further away from a cash base and more of it's on our plastic or over online. And if you lose access to that, you're stuck, you know. And some of these groups that were debanked, you know, they were given less than a week's notice to find a new way to, you know, process their payroll, pay their, you know, the invoices that they needed to take care of. And so it's a real problem that happens to these people, and for no, you know, apparently good reason. But, you know, it's something that we want to do to protect our citizens, to make sure that they do have access to their money and their ability to be part of our marketplace.
Yeah. There's multiple examples. President Trump's the most notorious example, or prominent, if you will, example of being debanked. After the 2020 election, Capital One, which there's since been some settlements on this, but Capital One debanked President Trump's private organization, not just his campaign account. They debanked his Trump organization, which runs all of his real estate transactions, et cetera. Millions of money flowing in and out. They canceled that without notice. Over the January 6th incident at the Capitol. AFA has been debanked and more technically deplatformed because Stripe Payment Processing, they're out of San Francisco, Uber left-wing company, but they cut us off like with 24-hour notice, and it was in December during our peak fundraising month. And it was, in essence, because of our religious and ideological viewpoints. They wouldn't say that, but that's what our suspicion is. I think Sam Brownback, former Secretary of State from
Kansas,
yeah, he was debanked as well. And there's more examples of this. There's been some pro-life groups that this has happened to. My point is that this is actually a thing. This isn't just a theoretical, this might happen. This has actually happened, right?
Oh, yeah, it has. And the examples you give out are on point. So what they do is they do it mostly through regulations, through the regulators that come into the banks. All banks are regulated. State charter banks are regulated by our state Department of Banking, and then national banks are regulated by national regulators. And so what those national regulators under the previous administration and their guidelines would come in, and they would pretty much say, well, this is a reputational risk of having this person on here. And that's
I've heard that term a lot.
Yeah. And so that's you know, that comes up. And so these banks, you know, they don't want these regulators on them. And so they kind of like old school gangsters with them, you know. Oh, I'd be sad if something happened to your bank here.
Yeah.
You know, so they would,
as they're looking at like a group that they want to have taken down.
So it was pressure coming from the regulators onto the banks. The banks weren't going out and choosing to do this just out of the blue. From the research I've been able to do, it looks like that they're getting pressure from these regulators.
Well, and to your point, when you have these different state regulators, I'm sure every state has their own board or commission or regulatory body. For example, if you have a California commission or regulatory body, you know, making a phone call to what is probably a national bank or a regional bank, and to your point, given these threats are alluding to being, you know, punished, so to speak, that definitely affects their decision making. So these regulatory bodies have a lot of power and influence, for better or worse.
Especially larger banks. So if you're over a $10 billion in asset bank, you have regulators in office 24/7.
Wow. They're
always there. And so those guys are under a lot of scrutiny. And, you know, in today's day and age, after the financial crisis in 08, the regulations on all of our financial institutions just went through the roof, and they are so overregulated. I've talked to other bankers saying, like, man, if we could go back to the old days, you know, it'd be a lot easier. I mean, they've adapted to the climate that it is, but
sure.
I think that they would all prefer to get rid of some of these regulations that are just over the top, and you know, pendulum swung from one way all the way to the other way, and we need to kind of probably be more in the middle, but that's, you know, what we're trying to do, but it really needs to happen more on the federal level, but
sure.
But we do what we can here in the state.
Yeah, and let's talk about that. So we're talking with Representative Shannon Gary from Mississippi, state representative from the northeastern part of Mississippi and Tupelo area specifically. Let's talk about solutions here, because obviously the problem of debanking is there. It's prevalent. We've talked about some of the cases of it happening. And to your point, we don't want to come in with a bunch of red tape, create another regulatory body, et cetera. So let's talk about the solutions here. What are some of the solutions, especially in some of this legislation you put forth, that we can address the concern of debanking without creating another government bureaucracy?
Right. And that's went in discussions with the bill that we had this past session with the bankers and with the banking commission was, we don't want to put more regulations on the bankers. And our goal was not to do that. What we did was, if a customer was debanked, and there was a whole list of reasons, and if they felt that they were, that they could file a complaint with the banking department. That, and then the banking department would look into it and do an investigation. And if it was proven to be a situation, then they would issue a cease and desist to that bank or financial institution and say, all right, y'all got to cut it out. This is why. But there was, and that was basically it, you know. Mm-hmm. But, you know, we were just trying to make it as simple and as not a regulatory burden on the banks. And some people, you know, were saying that there was a, you know, regulatory burden, but this, it wasn't like they're making it out to be. But
no, and to your point, and we met with some of the bankers. I'm sure you got phone calls and lunch requests as well. But the fact of the matter is, and I understand the hesitancy to, you know, sign off on any new regulations or any new statutes involving anything additional the banks have to do, right, or businesses in general. But to your point, correct me if I'm wrong, but this regulatory body or this banking association that this process was going to be facilitated within already exists.
It does.
So we're not creating a new agency,
no,
a new director, a new commission, or the governor having to appoint somebody new. This is an entity, a regulatory body that already exists. You're just simply creating a process within that body where someone can file a formal complaint, correct?
Yes.
Yeah.
That's it. And if the bank's not doing that, doing any debanking, then they don't have anything to worry about. I'm sure that there's going to be people out there who will say, oh, well, they debanked me and I did nothing wrong. There were a list of reasons in there of why they could.
Mm-hmm.
And that follows along with federal guidelines as well.
Sure.
But nothing like, you know, religious or political or anything like that
could, yeah,
be, or ideological. None of that could be included.
Yeah, that seems like a no-brainer. I mean, whether you're a Democrat or Republican, this is just good sense. And to your point, if the banks are following the rules, they have absolutely nothing to worry about. But the problem, to your point, and the word you used is, I think, reputational risk.
Right.
That's like a buzzword within the banking industry, where if they don't want to do business with a customer, they'll just pull out the Rolodex and say, yeah, your business is a reputational risk. We've had that specifically cited by different technology companies and others that don't want to do business with us. That's a buzzword for, we don't like what you guys do, pretty much. And to your point, I mean, the banks, if you're going to cut somebody's bank account off, you ought to be able to give them a viable reason. I mean, either they're engaged in criminal activity, or they're not following the banking guidelines, or they're not upholding their terms of service. But this is kind of a big deal. This isn't like, you know, I don't want to serve you coffee. This is banking. This is core to basically living in 2026.
Yeah. Well, and that's a fine line, because there are issues in banking where if there is some misconduct detected and the bank has to fill out some reports, they can't, by federal law, they can't let the person know.
Interesting.
Yeah, and so only the bank and
the regulator
know what about those suspicious activity reports.
So they don't want to tip off criminals that,
right,
like, hey, we're on to you.
Right,
gotcha.
Right. And so It's a fine line there on what they can let you know and what they can't let you know. And so if they debank someone or if someone is debanked because of one of those issues, they can't really tell them. But you would think, okay, well, we're not gonna do your business because you're an NRA member. You know, that's another, you know, situation altogether. So
yeah,
you have to keep those separate. And, you know, and we wanted to set the bill up where the banks weren't hit with a bunch of frivolous suits and complaints. Yeah. And so we tried to make it where they weren't just bombarded with those things as much as possible. But
yeah,
I'm sure some of them will cut through and cause some issues. But
yeah,
for the most part, we're trying to, you know, keep it as low as possible.
Yeah. Yeah. And this is not something I'm not trying to kind of undershoot my own argument here, but while there are cases of debanking happening, this I would not call this a massive, widespread problem, but it is a problem. And when people are debanked, it is a very big deal. So to Representative Aguirre's point, I don't see us having thousands or hundreds of thousands of complaints across the country if this were eligible. We're talking one-off instances of people being cut off.
Yes, and I completely agree. But I think, and in my thought with this was, someone's got to stand up and say, you know, we don't agree with this, and we're not going to accept it.
Yeah.
You know, and again, it was done on the federal level, but if the states start fighting back against it, then maybe something will happen. I mean, Senator Tim Scott from South Carolina, he had a bill, but as we all know, the Senate is in lockdown, right? You know, they can't.
Yeah, can't get anything done.
So we're trying to do something on the state level because, ideally, you know, President Trump had an executive order about debanking, but they can't get it over the finish line in the Senate.
So yeah,
Washington gridlock.
Well, and to your point about the state's role here, if we can get multiple states to band together on this, you could end this debanking with just having three or four states like Mississippi and Texas on the same page, because then the Capital Ones of the world are going, well, we don't have to deal with Mississippi and Texas as regulators, so we're just going to quit debanking, and then the problem solved. So, yeah, I mean, at this point, working together with various states is the way to go. Representative Aguirre, thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah, absolutely. Representative Shane Aguirre from the state of Mississippi, serving the northeastern part, specifically the Tupelo area, in the State House of Representatives. And glad to have him on the program. And he headed up this debanking legislation in Mississippi that we couldn't get quite over the finish line, but we're going to keep bringing it up, and we're going to keep pushing it and educating folks on it, so that we can protect consumers and individuals from having their bank accounts cut off for religious or political reasons. That goal should be pretty bipartisan. We'll be back in a few minutes.
The God Who Speaks is a powerful message on the authority of Scripture in the voices of some of the most respected theologians of our day.
The most historic formula for the Christian church has been this: when the Scripture speaks, God speaks.
The God Who Speaks is a 90-minute documentary which can empower Christians to share our faith and defend the authenticity of the Bible. Available at thegodwhospeaks.org or visit stream.afa.net.
In many ways, abortion was on the ballot this past election, and there's reason for concern. There are many counties, cities, and states who have radicalized abortion, and thousands of tiny babies will continue to lose their lives every day. Which is why the Ministry of Preborn is on the front lines for at-risk babies and mothers with unplanned pregnancies. Preborn sponsors clinics positioned in the highest abortion areas in the country by providing them with resources that they need to rescue babies. Preborn continues to expand their life-affirming care. Their end-of-year goal is to equip 10 more clinics with ultrasound machines. These life-saving machines cost $15,000 each, more than most clinics can afford. When a woman meets her baby on ultrasound, she is twice as likely to choose life. And when she comes to a preborn clinic, she will also be embraced with God's love. $28 sponsors one ultrasound, and now through a match, your gift is doubled. How many babies can you save? Please donate. Just dial #250 and say the keyword baby.
That's #250 and say the keyword baby, or you can go to preborn.com/AFR. That's preborn.com/AFR. All gifts are tax deductible, and Preborn has a 4-star charity rating.
This is At the Core on American Family Radio with your host, Walker Wildman.
Welcome back to The Core here on American Family Radio. Glad to have you with us on the program. Well, introducing our next guest that we have on the program, we have Chris Jacobs. He's CEO of the Juniper Research Group. He's on with us now to talk about the Medicaid work requirements provision that was put in statute last year and, of course, is being carried out now by the Trump administration. Chris, welcome to the program.
Great to be with you.
Well, Chris, anytime we can talk to someone about people working harder and getting off the couch, I'm 100% on board with that because it's a biblical concept, the concept of hard work and working with your hands and having honor and dignity in your work. It's a very kind of lost art, if you will, in America. Tell us about your organization, your research group, and then we'll jump into these work requirements.
Sure. Thanks, Walker. My organization, Juniper Research Group, it's a writing and research and consulting firm. I'm here in Washington, right in the middle of the DC swamp, trying to get people the story behind the story and explain really what's going on behind the scenes in Washington in ways that people can understand.
Excellent. Well, the One Big Beautiful Bill, one of the provisions in it, as you've noted coming out of the break, is that the work requirement for Medicaid, to qualify for Medicaid, the work requirement is now in statute, which is a very big deal. It's been expanded a little bit. But give us a little background on the work requirement. What are the provisions, how it works? And then we'll talk about the implications in the months ahead.
Sure. So the work requirement is only for states and populations that have expanded Medicaid under Obamacare. So we're not talking about making grandma work 40 hours or 80 hours a month or anything else like that. We're talking about primarily able-bodied adults in states that have expanded Medicaid under Obamacare to able-bodied adults. I think one thing that's important to remember here is Democrats, when they passed Obamacare, they gave states a greater Medicaid match to fund care for able-bodied adults than they did for aged, blind, disabled populations, the very sick, individuals with disabilities, pregnant women, children. It put able-bodied adults at the front of the line. And I've said consistently, that's an awful demonstration of values to encourage states to expand the able-bodied adult, somebody sitting on the couch, rather than the vulnerable, the most needy in our society.
Yeah, that's, to me, this is, not only is it immoral to disincentivize work and to cut into resources for the truly needy, and the long-term consequences are disastrous for our workforce and for our society and productivity. Talk about the updated work requirements that the Trump administration and Republicans put into place and what that's going to do, hopefully, to the tax obligations, the taxpayer obligations for the Medicaid program and getting people back in the workforce.
Sure. So the requirements in statute, and there were regulations implementing these that were released in early June, require 80 hours per month of some kind of work or community engagement. It could be education. It could be going back to school to make sure you have a good education, et cetera. It could be work. The other thing is it's actually, they say it's 80 hours per month, but in many ways, it's less than that because there's an income requirement that you can meet to fulfill the requirements. And it's 80 hours, it's equal to 80 hours at the federal minimum wage of $7.25 an hour. If you make $580 per month, you meet the requirements. Well, a lot of states have increased their minimum wage well above that. And in most places, most people get paid more than the minimum wage anyway. So if you're getting paid $10 an hour, then you only have to work 58 hours per month. So I think these are very reasonable, and we're talking about 80 hours per month. We're not talking about 80 hours per week to try to support indoor self-sufficiency. And people, the old saying of a hand up and not a handout.
Yeah, this the urgency to get people off of these welfare programs couldn't be higher. I mean, the amount of money to the tune of ultimately over $1 trillion annually when you combine some of these programs together, not just Medicare, but I'm talking Social Security, the whole package, right, of federal programs.
Yep.
Lot of money, and it's one of the reasons we're hitting such a deficit so quickly and not able to pay our bills. The urgency here to level some of this out or at least begin to chip away at it couldn't be overstated. And that's why I was so excited about some of the DOGE cuts. And, you know, we are at the lowest federal workforce since like the 50s or 60s. So President Trump has made some headway on this. But we got to keep going. I mean, Chris, the problem here is so bad that doing one thing is not enough. Like, we got to keep chipping away at this problem, correct?
Absolutely right. I mean, essentially, we're a big insurance company. The federal government is a big insurance company that has an army attached to it. And that's basically all we do. And that includes Medicare and Social Security, and it will ultimately require making some difficult decisions. I think the low-hanging fruit is going after some of the waste and the fraud. People were enrolled in multiple state Medicaid programs at the same time. Well, that's absurd. There's no point in that. That's just more profit to the insurance company. So we need to do some of these kinds of things. The big, beautiful bill started that, but we're going to need to keep going.
Hmm. Yeah, we are going to have to keep going. And there's obviously talk of another round of reconciliation. I think they call it 3.0. Do you think they're going to do something here? Like, is that being talked about, or are we going to have to bring it up?
I think it always involves being the squeaky wheel, because yeah. It's very easy. When you're a politician, you want to get liked. And so you get votes by handing out money. You don't get votes by taking money away and say, you know, being the bad father. No, you cannot have ice cream for breakfast, lunch, and dinner every day. I mean, that's effectively what we're talking about here. So it's always going to involve work and making difficult political choices, and really some people having the courage, because we're mortgaging our futures for our children and grandchildren, that they are going to live a life crushed with our debt, basically.
Mm.
And that's not fair to them.
No, it's not. It's not moral either. It's just wrong. To your point earlier about, you know, at some point we're going to have to cut. I don't think that's an exaggeration. I know people roll their eyes when we start talking about the deficit, because we just keep going. And it seems like there's no end to the deficit. We're going to hit $40 trillion by the fall. And it's just insane, that amount of debt per capita, per person for the government. But I do think that at some point it's going to have to be addressed. And to your point, the first thing that's going to be talked about is, where can we cut? Because you can't, despite, I know President Trump, they've said they want to grow their way out of this. I just don't know you can grow your way out of $40 trillion. You can grow your way out of a couple hundred billion, not $40 trillion. So cuts are going to have to be talked about. We may have to get into a crisis for that to be talked about. But Europe has had to make cuts. I mean, some of these other countries that have had debt crises, they have to make cuts at some point, whether you like it or not, right?
That's right. We can do this the easy way or the hard way. I mean, to give you a real easy sense of how bad it is, we could eliminate Social Security, abolish it this year, and still have a budget deficit. And you think about all the people,
wow,
all the senior citizens, all the individuals with disabilities getting payments from Social Security. You zero out each and every one of those, and we would still have a budget deficit.
Wow.
So the idea that you can do this by just eliminating foreign aid or that kind of stuff, it's untrue.
Yeah.
Yeah, it is. Well, let me ask you this. What are the state's role here? Because I know this is a federal provision. The agencies are carrying this out, as you mentioned. It's now in place. What can the states do to also help in this arena?
Well, I think the best thing that the states can do, first of all, if you haven't expanded Obamacare to able-bodied adults, then don't. Certainly, we've seen that in where you're talking from, Mississippi, that there's been pushes. Yep. And certainly the hospitals and the medical providers want to expand it. And this is the problem, is that the states see Washington and Medicaid as, quote, free money.
Yeah.
And so they come up with all these schemes that are that if you and I tried to do it, we would get put in jail for money laundering and fraud. But they're legal for states to do it. And really, they're just these sham transactions that are designed to bilk Washington out of more money.
Yeah. Yeah.
So it states need to be independent about this. And if you want to raise taxes on your own citizens to pay for a big welfare state, then go ahead and do that. I disagree with that.
Mm-hmm.
But don't come to Washington through all these sham mechanisms and think there's just an unlimited tap on the federal spigot.
Yeah, and what you're alluding to there and talking about is ultimately the big problem, capital B-I-G, and that is that the states, and of course, Washington's got its fair share of problems because they don't mind giving out the money, but this pork and this excessive bloated spending that the states expect from Washington is just insane. I mean, as quote conservative as Mississippi is politically, ideologically, we are just munching off of Washington D.C. and it's a shame.
Yep.
And I've even told our elected officials, look, you guys are going to have to wean yourself off of this federal dollar, because when Washington comes, they're gonna when Biden's in the White House, what do? They tell Mississippi what to do. Why? Because they send us the money. So. I think we're at like a two for one. For every $1 we spend in the budget, $2 come from D.C. I think that's right, maybe more than that. But it's really, really a problem. And so I think the more that time goes on and the more ideologically divided we become as a country, the more necessary this is going to be for states to be more self-sufficient.
That's exactly right. And the problem really with healthcare and the problem with our government in general is that everybody does a wonderful job of spending everybody else's money.
You're right. You're right.
And that's the old Margaret Thatcher phrase from 50 years ago, that the problem with socialism is eventually you run out of other people's money. And this is the problem. This is why we spend too much money in healthcare in general, because my insurance plan pays for it, or in Medicaid because the state pays for it, or in Medicare because the federal government's paying for it. Everybody does a wonderful job. And I understand when you have a heart attack, you're not going to be able to pay for all of that out of pocket.
Sure.
But it's this attitude of everybody throwing the bill to somebody else.
Yes.
Rather than self-sufficiency.
Yeah. And let's address that. We've just got a couple minutes left. But this fear-mongering that we get when we talk about, and we started out on work requirements for Medicaid, but you can apply this to any other program. And even like Obamacare, they'll say, well, you know, if somebody's having a heart attack, you know, it doesn't matter what it costs. We got to save their life. Well, whatever. Okay, there's already federal statutes on having to serve people in the emergency room anyway. That's why the illegals go and get free, quote, free treatment, even though we pay for it. But that those are the statistical anomalies. When you go to the emergency room, what do you get? Somebody, my ear's hurting, I got an earache, you know, and they go in there and they don't pay any bills. And then the hospital, what do? They charge you and me and our private healthcare plans an overage to make up for the people that don't pay for common things that can often be addressed at a small, you know, in and out 30-minute medical clinic. But the people that don't have health insurance go to the ER because they know they can't turn them away. And so that same kind of entitlement mentality and abuse of the system mentality is why Medicare and others have these massive problems. But Chris Jacobs, I'll give you the last word. We got about a minute left.
The other thing I would say, I agree with all of that, but the other thing that we need is transparency. If you can't figure out what things cost, then you can't do the right thing.
Yeah.
I mean, I went through this just with some of my prescriptions that I realized I was paying three times as much for a prescription because I was using my insurance plan than just taking out my credit card and paying cash. Because the big healthcare conglomerates keep all this stuff opaque.
Yes.
And so that's where the Trump administration, and frankly, this has been bipartisan, to make it more transparent about what things cost. Because then, whether it's an individual themselves or the employers, when it can actually start cracking down on where all this fat and bloat is in the system, because there's tons of it, but you don't know because you can't see where things are.
Absolutely. We ought to be able to shop for health care like we shop for everything else. You ought to be able to compare two hospital systems, compare multiple providers, and figure out who's going to give you the best service for the best price. That's what we do with every other goods and service in the economy. But this whole healthcare is just shrouded in secrecy and, you know, non-answers, and it's very frustrating. Chris Jacobs, thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Absolutely. Chris Jacobs, Juniper Research Group, glad to have him. We'll see you next time. We'd like to thank our sponsors, including Preborn. Preborn has rescued over 400,000 babies from abortion, and every day their network clinics rescue 200 babies' lives. Will you join Preborn in loving and supporting young moms in crisis? Save a life today. Go to preborn.com/AFR.
The views and opinions expressed in this broadcast may not necessarily reflect those of the American Family Association or American Family Radio.